ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, tougher penalties could be on the way for supermarkets abusing their power. Could it really lead to shoppers paying less and farmers being paid more? Also, we'll hear about the Australians who've convinced themselves they don't have to pay tax like the rest of us, and the Orange Pass that gets you access to the nation's leaders calls for a crackdown on political lobbyists.
Lobbyists who have an Orange Pass can walk the corridors, knock on the door, stick their head around the corner and come and talk to parliamentarians and staff members without anyone knowing who they're meeting with or what they're talking about.
Thanks for your company. A better deal for shoppers and for farmers. That's what the Albanese government has pledged today with the release of a report recommending a mandatory code of conduct for the major supermarkets. The opposition has rubbished the proposal to hit Coles, Woolworths, Aldi and IGA's parent company Metcash with hefty fines if they engage in serious anti-competitive behaviour. The government-commissioned report was carried out by a former Labor minister, but as Gavin Coote reports, it stops short of recommending powers to break up the big supermarket chains.
Australia's heavily concentrated supermarket sector and its relationship with suppliers is under heightened scrutiny. An interim review of the industry is now calling for a much tougher approach.
This is about getting a better deal for people right up and down the supply chain.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers has given in-principle support to the review's 8 recommendations put forward by former Labor Minister and economist Craig Emerson. They include multi-million dollar fines and a mandatory code of conduct for the supermarket giants. Dr. Chalmers says it'll improve competition and push down prices at the checkout.
We want to strengthen the code. An important part of that is making it mandatory, imposing penalties, making sure that we get the dispute resolution right. All of those key features of those 8 recommendations from Craig are something we are interested in progressing, subject to a few weeks of genuine consultation.
What isn't on the table is new breakup powers that could force Coles and Woolworths to sell off parts of their business if a court ordered them to do so, something the Nationals and the Greens have been calling for.
That's not something that we have been exploring because we have found better, more effective ways to deal with some of the issues in our competition policy landscape.
The opposition is dismissive of the report, and leader Peter Dutton questions whether it'll lead to lower prices for consumers.
I think this is a Mickey Mouse review that's been conducted by a Labor mate with an outcome predetermined by the Treasurer.
Mr. Dutton hasn't been as equivocal in his support for breakup powers as his Nationals colleagues, and even Liberal frontbencher James Patterson, who today said such powers are needed to prevent anti-competitive behaviour. While not committing to that idea, the opposition leader has lashed the government for not keeping all options available.
The US, Canada, the UK has divestiture powers, so it's not unreasonable for Australia to have a look at it. We know that Coles and Woolies now have their own development branches, property development branches, so we know that they're holding blocks of land to squeeze other competitors out of that marketplace. And to the extent that that is causing an upward pressure on prices, and consumers are paying more and more for their groceries when they get to the checkout, of course it's something that we're looking at.
Guy Gaeta agrees. He's a cherry and apple grower at Orange in central West New South Wales, who argues unfair pricing has led many of the region's producers to leave the industry.
20-odd years ago, we used to have around 200 orchardists around here. We're now down to about 12. Some got out with dignity. Some got out, kept on trying and trying and lost everything. But my motto is, if you supply Woolies and Coles, you'll eventually go broke. And they are. Our farmers are dropping off like flies in horticulture. Look, we need divestive powers, even if you're not going to use them, but it's a good stick to make sure that they do the right thing.
If adopted, the mandatory code would apply to Coles, Woolworths, Aldi and Metcash, which is the parent company of IGA and Foodland. Graham Hughes is a consumer and retail expert with Griffith University. He points out the government needs to tread a fine line by improving competition without crushing the market altogether.
Because at the end of the day, Coles and Woolworths and Aldi's and IGA's and the like, they're a vital part of the thread of the nation. We need them to be viable businesses.
When we look at the stiffer penalties that are being discussed here, they could be up to $10 million or 10% of a supermarket's annual turnover. Would this be enough for a major supermarket giant like Coles or Woolworths to actually feel that if they did wrong?
Well, I think that it's a reasonable amount, and I do think that it will certainly make the supermarkets stop and think before acting. You know, sure, you could look at the balance sheets and argue that really it's something that would be water off a duck's back. However, it's something that wouldn't stand the test of time, and something also that shareholders will be looking at as they sort of look at their investments going forward as well. So if an organisation is copping these breaches and penalties, it doesn't bode too well.
Both Coles and Woolworths say they support a mandatory code of conduct, while the company Metcash says it's considering the interim report and its implications for its business. Craig Emerson will deliver his final report by the end of the financial year.
Gavin Coote there. Well, Andrew Lee is the Assistant Minister for Competition and Employment, and he joined me earlier. Andrew Lee, thanks for being with us. The Prime Minister says prices will absolutely go down for consumers at the checkout. Explain for us how prices will come down when supermarkets are paying more for the products they're stocking shelves with.
Well, David, Australia has one of the most concentrated supermarket sectors in the world, and it's really important that we apply an appropriate level of scrutiny to that sector. We've got three major pieces of work going on at the moment. There's Craig Emerson's review of the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, which governs the supermarket's relationship with their suppliers. There's the ACCC's inquiry into grocery competition, which will look at both consumer and supplier issues. And then there's Choice undertaking quarterly price monitoring, which will help Australians work out where to get the better deal. We believe that through better transparency, better accountability and stronger competition laws that we're able to ensure that consumers and suppliers get a better deal.
So does that mean then that supermarkets get hit, that their profits will be lower?
Well, we're a strongly pro-business government, and indeed you've seen business investment do much better under this government than under the former government.
I'm just trying to understand this though, because if supermarkets are paying more for their products and charging less, something's got to give. They've either got to take lower profits to shareholders, or they've got to offer less services to customers, or lower wages to workers. Something's got to give, doesn't it?
David, I think there's often a tendency to try and boil these things down to a zero-sum game. But part of this also is the conduct of the supermarkets. One of the things that Craig Emerson's review has heard is that there are instances in which suppliers fear retaliation so they don't raise issues with the supermarkets. Under a voluntary code, without the sort of independent arm's length process, you often don't get the sort of honesty from suppliers that you might get in a more open market. And with a duopoly of supermarkets, there's a lot at stake for a supplier who complains and then fears retribution. And that's why Craig Emerson is recommending we move to a mandatory code with serious penalties. So this will, if the government was to go down that path, provide a greater level of confidence for farmers that they're getting a fair deal in their dealings with big supermarkets.
Yeah, so just one more on this. You're saying consumers will get a better deal, suppliers will get a better deal. Will supermarkets get as good a deal as they've had in the last couple of years?
Look, we expect supermarkets will continue to thrive. This has been a
as
strong...
As much as they have been, though?
Look, the health of the supermarkets is important to Australians. Woolworths is Australia's biggest private sector employer. It's why I was very troubled earlier this year when Peter Dutton was urging people to boycott Woolworths. It's as though he doesn't think that there's 200,000 Australians that work there. It's why the Labor government doesn't believe that divestiture should be a first choice option, because like the ACTU and the National Farmers Federation, we're concerned about those who work at supermarkets. So we're looking at the whole picture here, focused on practical reforms that'll make a difference for farmers and make a difference for consumers.
Well, speaking of the whole picture, the Prime Minister said this morning we need a code of conduct that looks at the entire supply chain. Does that include online shopping outlets like Amazon, which now stock many of the products that you can get in the supermarket aisle?
Well, the recommendation that Craig Emerson has made is that the threshold for the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct should stay at $5 billion turnover. That means that you'd have Coles, Woolworths, Aldi and Metcash coming in. Costco sitting at around $4 billion, if it continued to grow, would conceivably come in the future.
What about Amazon?
As I understand it, Amazon is sitting around $1 billion of turnover, so it's well below that threshold. I've certainly heard some people making the case for Amazon being brought into the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct. Craig Emerson's view, as an independent reviewer who's spoken to experts and stakeholders across the sector, is that the time for that isn't now.
Andrew Lee, thanks for being with us.
Real pleasure, David. Thank you.
And Andrew Lee is the Assistant Minister for Competition and Employment. Well, how much should we know about just who is meeting with our leaders in the Australian Parliament and what they are talking about? That's a question being examined by a Senate inquiry that started public hearings in Canberra today. The lobbying inquiry heard a lack of transparency means vested interests can exert undue influence on our decision makers. Here's Rachel Hayder.
An orange pass is your golden ticket to the halls of Australian power.
They give you free access to the back passageways of Parliament House.
Monique Ryan is the independent federal member for Kooyong.
Lobbyists who have an orange pass can walk the corridors, knock on the door, stick their head around the corner and come and talk to parliamentarians and staff members without anyone knowing who they're meeting with or what they're talking about.
To get one of these orange passes, you need to be sponsored by a member of the House or a senator.
We do not know how many orange passes are in circulation in Parliament House, and we don't know who the people who hold those passes are meeting with. We don't know who sponsors someone who has an orange pass, and there has been a bit of consternation in recent times about people who represent what we would call harmful industries, whether that be tobacco or gambling or alcohol industries.
That lack of transparency is part of the focus of a Senate inquiry into lobbying, which held its first public hearing in Canberra today. Among those giving evidence was Kate Griffiths, a public policy researcher with the Grattan Institute.
To publish who has these behind-the-scenes access passes to Parliament House is a step in the right direction. That would be helping Australians understand who has access to the corridors of power. It's not the whole picture of lobbying, but it is an important part of the picture of lobbying.
In September 2018, Grattan published a report called Who's in the Room? Access and Influence in Australian Politics. It looked at who is meeting with senior ministers at a state level.
The best information available about who has access to senior decision makers is the state data, because the states are publishing more information about this than is published at the federal level. In terms of specific industries, some of the groups that get a lot of access, the gambling industry, they get a lot more access than you would expect for their contribution to the economy. Energy and resources groups and amongst transport industry groups, these are some of the most highly regulated industries, so it's not surprising that businesses and peak bodies in these spaces are knocking on doors, but it is a problem if we can't balance out some of those debates with groups on the other side who may not be as well resourced.
And that balance matters, not just in terms of fairness, but legally too. Anne Toomey is a Professor Emerita in Constitutional Law at the University of Sydney. She also spoke to the lobbying inquiry today, telling senators the High Court has interpreted the Constitution as guaranteeing equal participation of people in the political system.
If we want to be true to that guarantee, we can't really have a system where some people are favoured by getting easy access to members of Parliament to lobby them, and other people are excluded from that. There doesn't seem to be any kind of fair process for determining who's included and who's excluded.
Professor Toomey believes Parliament should be supporting that principle of equal participation by allowing equal access to the halls of power.
That might include just not giving orange passes to anyone in the lobbying field and allowing all of them instead to be ordinary temporary visitors to Parliament who have an escorted pass. So everyone's on the same level playing field. At the very least, making it transparent as to who has the passes and who's sponsoring those passes. And through that transparency and any criticism that might arise because of that, leading to a more open and fair system.
Monique Ryan tabled a private members' bill in November proposing an improved lobbyist register and code of conduct. Her proposed Clean Up Politics Act also includes opening up ministers' diaries so the public knows who is meeting with our leaders and why.
I've spoken to the government about it on a number of occasions. The Attorney General has indicated at this point that he doesn't want to progress with it. This is a source of significant frustration given that many of the improvements to transparency and integrity that are proposed in my bill are things that he has spoken to whilst in opposition.
A spokesperson for the Attorney General told PM the government will await the findings from this inquiry and carefully consider any recommendations it makes. The committee is due to report at the end of next month.
Rachel Hayter reporting there. This is PM with me, David Lipson. You can hear all of our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Japan is expected to bolster its military cooperation with the United States this week as Prime Minister Fumio Kishida meets with US President Joe Biden in Washington. It could see Japan plug into elements of the AUKUS Pact alongside Australia, the US and the UK. But there are significant hurdles to overcome and a perilous path to walk to avoid ratcheting up tensions with China. Professor Peter Dean is Director of Foreign Policy and Defence at the US Studies Centre at Sydney University.
It's a very important meeting. Japan is one of the key US allies of the United States in the Indo-Pacific region and in particular in East Asia. There is a very, very long and deep alliance relationship between the two countries, and it's one of the cornerstones of peace and security in East Asia. And what we've heard is probably a couple of key things. A potential for Japan entering part of the AUKUS arrangement. We've heard Rahm Emanuel, who's the current United States ambassador to Japan, raise potential around this in recent days. And of course, he's very connected into the Democratic Party institution, given his long role, including being chief of staff to President Obama. And of course, Kirk Campbell, who's now into the State Department in the second most important diplomatic role, mentioned this in an interview the other day.
What are the hurdles that would have to be overcome for Japan to be part of AUKUS?
Look, there's some considerable hurdles, and the biggest hurdle of all is the security measures. One of the reasons AUKUS came into existence, because it's not an alliance, it's a technology sharing pact to uplift military technology and capabilities in all three countries. And that means we're dealing with some of the most highly sensitive, cutting-edge military capabilities and intelligence innovation and technology in the world. So getting the Japan up to the security settings that they're required, so that's both the cybersecurity settings, but also the personal security settings and the industrial security settings and the counter-espionage measures that need to be put in place, would be the biggest hurdle. So I suspect if something does happen around AUKUS, they said it would be on a specific line of effort or a specific project, which then for the Japanese, they'll be able to ring-fence with the required security requirements to ensure that that very highly sensitive technology stays only between the three AUKUS partners and Japan.
So if this does happen as expected, it is another one of these, as they're called, mini-laterals, isn't it? Because there's the Quad, which involves India. There's also, well, we saw this military drill over the weekend that involved Japan, the US, the Philippines and Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can look at trilateral groupings as well. So there's a very strong now Japan, Australia, United States trilateral security dialogue. We've seen, for instance, in recent months, moves between Japan, Korea and the United States doing another trilateral. And that's very significant because of the long historical difficulties between the Japan-Korea relationship. And so I think what you're seeing is this growth over the recent years, and AUKUS and the Quad and these other groupings are examples of this, of smaller security groupings that are based on addressing specific security issues, topics or themes. And we're seeing this constantly happening around the region, different countries who can agree on particular topics and issues getting together to address those.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like a series of small webs that all together feel a bit like a net. And perhaps China may see it that way as some attempt to contain it. Could that be a problem?
Well, I don't think we're talking about containment here.
Could China see it that way?
Well, of course, this is the key thing. What the United States, Australia, Japan is trying to do is to deter certain actions from China against states in the region to change the regional strategic balance. Now, deterrence, as we say in the game, only exists in the mind of your adversary or the person you're trying to deter. And, of course, that's very difficult to get in their mind. If people read this the wrong way or understand these in the wrong way, it can have negative effects. So it's really emboldened upon these countries to really clearly message why they're doing that, what they're attempting to achieve with this, and what's the outcome of this. And, of course, China doesn't mind doing this themselves. I mean, China's relationship with Iran, with North Korea and with Russia, for instance, has burgeoned at the same time. What we're attempting to do is maintain that strategic balance, particularly against the coercive actions that China have been taking.
Professor Peter Dean, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Professor Peter Dean is from the US Studies Centre at Sydney University. Well, no one likes paying tax, but as they say, along with death, it's one of the only certainties of this world. Some Australians, though, have convinced themselves they don't have to pay tax simply because they don't believe in the legitimacy of the government. The concept is called financial sovereignty, and it has some similarities with the sovereign citizens movement that rose up during the pandemic. As Amber Jacobs reports, though, it doesn't fly with investigators from the tax office.
An articulate, friendly woman looks into the camera and introduces herself as, wait for it, the spiritual accountant. She makes a whole bunch of claims, including the bizarre idea that tax is not compulsory. The ABC has seen this Facebook video, and while it's easy to laugh at, it's also very worrying.
What we find is that there's almost a mercenary class of gurus out there that are making quite a substantial amount of money out of quite vulnerable people by peddling these sort of claims.
Joe McIntyre is an associate professor in law at the University of South Australia. The Facebook page we've just described has more than 4,000 followers, and it's not the only example of would-be finance coaches convincing people to stop paying tax.
So they tend to charge subscription fees and run expensive seminars for people to come along and hear these sorts of claims. Most of these claims are completely spurious. Some of them are downright illegal. Some of the advice is itself criminal in conduct.
It's an ideology that's taken hold among conspiracy groups, emerging as a byproduct of the infamous sovereign citizen movement, which rejects the legitimacy of government. Dr. Liam Gillespie is a lecturer in criminology at the University of Melbourne and has studied fringe movements, including sovereign citizens. He says recent global events like the pandemic have spurred a lack of trust in government.
There's a complex range of factors that attract people to those particular ideologies. In the last couple of years, particularly through COVID-19, for some of them, it gives them a sense of meaning, a sense of security, a sense of community. For others, it gives them just something to do, almost like a pastime or a hobby, something that they can be passionate about. It can give them an outlet for particular grievances that they might hold about their station in life or their particular situation. And it just provides an overall sort of wraparound framework to help them to explain the situation that they're in.
Seminars have popped up across major cities and online, promoting the idea that paying tax is voluntary. In one example, a man who attended a seminar in 2019 was so convinced that he tried to claim $70,000 in deductions in his tax return to cover the likes of rent, clothing, food, and phone bills. He insisted tax was not compulsory, but his argument was found to be groundless and illogical, and he was fined $14,000. That case hasn't stopped other people from turning to the idea of financial sovereignty. And according to Joe McIntyre, the wider sovereign citizen movement is affecting a number of government departments.
It's adding significant costs to a range of government departments. There are extremist movements for some of these fringe movements. So we're getting death threats against public officials and judges. We're causing a lot of disruption in court proceedings and in other similar matters. So we can sort of imagine it like a small amount of trauma to a lot of government departments rather than something that's being overwhelming one single department.
He says it's only a matter of time before someone vulnerable finds themselves in serious legal trouble.
What I'd like to see is the regulators using the powers that they already have so that people who are making these sort of false claims are being hit with the additional penalties, and people that are peddling, the mercenaries that are peddling these claims are probably the people they should be going after first.
The Australian Taxation Office says claims that people can opt out of the tax system or that the ATO does not have legal legitimacy are simply untrue.
That report from Amber Jacobs and Hannah Murphy. Well, what would you do if you had a spare $10 million? Would you ever dream of spending it all on one solitary animal? A massive record was set today in the world of Australian horse racing. The first foal out of legendary Australian racehorse Winx was sold at auction for that huge $10 million price tag. And while return on investment might not be guaranteed, the owners have bought themselves a slice of Australian history. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Stood before a crowd of onlookers at auction earlier today, the filly, whose mother was known as Queen of the Turf, stood ready to make a statement.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a filly by Piero from our idol in Winx. She's taken it all in, as rightly she should, as her mother did on so many occasions. 25 Group 1 wins, 37 races. She says hello.
The bidding at the Inglis Easter yearling sale began at $2 million, and competition was fierce, with the first foal out of legendary race mare Winx drawing international interest. But the prize horse will remain in Australian hands for a record-breaking price.
At $10 million, $10 million. But I'm going to sell her, make no mistake, at $10 million, take $500 more, at $10 million, last chance, done.
The winning bid came from Winx's former part owner, Debbie Kapitis, who became emotional during a post-auction press conference.
I didn't come here to buy this horse originally. We put her up for auction, and then in the last few weeks, all of the family, we started to miss our daughter, granddaughter. So we just decided that as best we could, if we could get her, we would.
The sale sets an all-time record for a thoroughbred yearling, which is a horse aged between 1 and 2. The sale doubles the $5 million paid for Black Caviar's half-brother in 2013 and dwarfs the previous filly yearling record of $2.6 million. Debbie Kapitis says the filly will be trained by Chris Waller, who trained Winx.
She's Australian forever. And she's going to be just fabulous.
Winx herself made Australasian history with a winning streak of 33 races before her retirement in 2019.
Well, I think the thing that comes to light whenever you mention Winx is just her extraordinary bravery.
Helen Thomas is a journalist and broadcaster and author of several books about Australian racing.
She faced the best in Australia, and she faced the best that international theatre could send her way, and she won 33 times in a row. So I think anyone, whether they, you know, love horse racing or not, can appreciate that extraordinary achievement.
Helen Thomas says while Winx's legend is well known, the record-breaking price for her filly, sired by another champion, Stallion Piero, is staggering.
It was just extraordinary, and I doubt it'll be a very long time before that happens again in Australia or anywhere in the world.
But while Winx amassed more than $26 million in prize money throughout her career, is there any guarantee that her daughter can achieve the same heights?
I think even the most hopeful owner would find it very difficult to believe that they will recoup that sort of, you know, prize money, even in Australia where the prize money is so healthy at the moment. $26 million is an extraordinary amount to win. But even if this filly just wins a few races, her value isn't really necessary as a brilliant racehorse. Can she be as brilliant as her mum? Can she be as brave as her mum? It doesn't matter, because if you're a filly, your value can continue as a broodmare when you retire from the racetrack.
So despite future races or despite future prize money, this is a good investment either way.
I think particularly if you're Debbie Capetus, it's a fantastic investment.
That's journalist Helen Thomas ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. And that's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. Don't forget, all of our interviews and reports can be found on the PM webpage. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. We're meant to be transitioning to a greener future and getting rid of gas for good, but now we're talking about drilling for more of it. Today, energy reporter Dan Mercer explains how we've ended up here. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.